We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Across time and across cultures, people have feared and told stories about monsters. Our guest for this hour, Stephen Asma, he's professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago, says that while the monster is indeed a product of our imagination, imagination is the driving force behind our perception of the world. And he says, if we find monsters in the world, it is sometimes because they are really there, and sometimes because we have brought them with us. This morning, we'll explore some monster stories, both past and present, and try to get a better understanding of just what it is we are afraid of. That is the subject that Stephen Asma explores in his recently published book, which is titled On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears is the subtitle. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And Stephen Asma is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions, comments are welcome. We just ask people to be brief and on the topic. But if you can do that, you're welcome to call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And also toll-free 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, the toll-free. Otherwise, again, locally, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And Professor Asma, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. If one were to do a comprehensive encyclopedia of monsters, either that would be one very big book or it would be a multi-volume series. So one thing you certainly know is that if you look, as I said, if you look across cultures and across time, many, many different kinds of monsters and different monster stories. So I think you make the point that there's really no one definition. But is there, do you think, are there some universals that start to emerge if you look at the kind of stories that people tell about monsters?
Yeah, I think that's right. I basically, if I was going to try to do an encyclopedia, it would be a multi-volume work. And instead, I am looking for some of these more universal qualities. I think when you see monsters appearing in the ancient world, in the medieval world, in the Renaissance, in the scientific era, and up to the present, so oftentimes they represent things that human beings cannot really reason with. It's some sort of an enemy that we can't really use diplomacy on. It's sort of beyond the range of human rationality. And so they sort of represent our worst fears about an enemy that basically could exploit our greatest vulnerabilities. And so you see that time and time again.
Mm-hmm. And you suggest, I think there's good reason to believe that some of the fears that give rise to monsters and monster stories are very deeply rooted in some of the oldest parts of our brains. And what they are is reflections of very old and very real fears about things that in the past, maybe in the distant past, would have been real threats to our survival, things that there were good reasons to be afraid of.
Yeah, that's right. I think most psychologists and evolutionary psychologists have noticed that arachnophobia, fear of spiders, is very universal, as is fear of snakes. And there also seems to be a lot of fears based around the big cats, wolves, and sharks. My own greatest fear is deep water, and I think it's reasonable to suspect that these fears were probably rooted in real predator-prey relationships. We were hunted by big cats, on the plains of Africa for a long time. It turns out there are, in fact, several species of very poisonous spiders and snakes in the regions where the hominids evolved. And the assumption is that If the monsters aren't sort of occupying the limbic brain, then they're probably even deeper in the reptile brain, and they probably are good survival mechanisms. You know, if you have phobias and you err on the side of caution, you might live on to procreate another day. And so many of us, myself included, think that probably some of our monster fears are way in the brain, a kind of circuit or module, and then the neocortex, the imagination, can go to work on these and turn them into even more fantastic creatures.
Yeah, and I think you also make the point there are these universals, there are in fact some fears that will be culture and place specific, and probably, for example, people who have lived all their lives in the desert maybe aren't going to have a fear of deep water.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Anthropologists can really give us a sense of the sort of peculiar diversity of monster culture in different cultures because, as you point out, the geographic region, the actual animals, the flora and fauna of your region are going to dictate the way in which you conceptualize threats. So you'll find that frequently werewolves and wolf-type creatures dominate in areas like northern Europe, and you're not going to find that in African regions. So I do believe there's a sort of universal, but then it gets written over by the sort of local culture, and then, you know, on top of that, we have the literary cultures of the different regions as well.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that then you come to this question that we are now modern technological people. We like to think of ourselves as rational. I don't think we're as rational as we like to think we are, but we like to think of ourselves as rational. So the question is, why is it that we haven't outgrown all of this?
Yeah, good question. I think because, it's interesting that there's a kind of bubble of people who are highly educated and see themselves as rationalists, and have sort of moved away from supernatural monsters. Mm-hmm. But in point of fact, many of these supernatural monsters still trouble the vast majority, even in the developed West. So I just would want to make that point as well, that there are a lot of people who are afraid of the devil, for example, and not in some symbolic way, but in a quite literal way. But having said that, I do think we do understand the causes of things better than we did before, and we don't have to sort of attribute mental illness to demon possession or anything like that. But we are always going to be vulnerable. That's part of the human condition. I don't think it matters how many books you read or how much science we do. We are always going to have fears about what could happen to our loved ones, what could happen to ourselves. And those fears, I think, are basically picked up by the monster tradition and sort of celebrated. That's the focus of monster culture, are those deep vulnerabilities.
Yeah. I think it's one of the things you point out that I think is very interesting is you look at the very word monster, which is a word that comes from Latin, and the root, some people, I guess, think the root is the Latin word that means to warn. So
right.
In that sense, monsters and monster stories are cautionary tales. They're warning about something.
Yeah, that's right. If you go back to the earliest uses of the term in the Greek and Roman world, at least in the West, it was generally considered, if a monster appeared or there was some story of a monster, it was taken to be a warning about the fates and what might happen. And at that time, there was a great fascination in what came to be called human monsters, and of course we don't use that term anymore because it's really a fairly unpleasant term to apply to developmental or genetically disabled kids. So you'd have somebody who was born a conjoined twin, you know, or somebody missing limbs or something like this, and this was taken to be by the Greeks and Romans a kind of omen. And military strategists would sort of change their entire strategies based on the discovery of a conjoined twin in the village or something like this. And that has sort of, that tradition is still with us because we do, I think, still use monsters even in popular culture like movies and novels as a kind of warning.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Stephen Asma. He's professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago, where he holds the title of Distinguished Scholar, and he is the author of the book On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm sure that you can slice this history up into a number of ways, and maybe the one major dividing point might be, let us say, between at the point where we start to have modern science, however one wants to define that. Was there a big change as people started to learn more about the world outside of their immediate neighborhood and started to at least have a little bit better understanding of how the physical world operated?
Yeah, I think that's the case, definitely with regard to, like I was referring to, embryology and obstetrics and the development of our understanding of the causes of conception and growth. We studied monsters there, particularly I look at stuff in the early scientific revolution that basically really started to rehumanize those diverse or disabled people that had been approached with so much fear, I think, in the past. But I think, one of the tendencies of monster culture is to look at the forces within us that are frightening and that sort of come out, things like rage or sexual lust or this kind of stuff. You see in the ancient Greeks that there's a lot of talk about almost being possessed by Eros or whatever it is, and there's a tremendous fear about monsters inside us, and then this gets elaborated in medieval culture as a kind of literal supernatural possession. But by the time you get to Freud and into more scientific psychology, we have notions of inner psychic forces, and we like to think we have a better handle on this, although the forces still sort of leap up and frighten us and surprise us. And so I think now our use of monster with regard to these inner monsters is oftentimes the epithet is usually used to apply to people like serial killers and psychopaths. And we're trying to express something about being alienated from yourself, I think, in this description.
Yeah. Well, I think it's striking here that even though the people have explained it in different ways, there always has been this recognition that there were inner monsters, and that I suppose now what we would say is that we're projecting. We're taking things, dark things inside of ourselves that we know are there and that we're really uncomfortable with, and trying to understand them, and by taking them outside of ourselves and embodying them, it makes it possible to try to examine them in a maybe slightly more objective way, but that also gives you, it may be figurative, but a way to take those things on.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you can project these inner fears onto some object or some sort of abstract person, then you can attempt to defeat it. And, I sort of discuss Freud a little bit. I'm not entirely a Freudian on this, but I think he's right about this, that it makes sense that you would project these evil creatures out there that you could either run away from or destroy when if they are in fact in you, you really can't run away from that because that's a part of who you are, and that's a doomed project. So this is a kind of way of dealing with or trying to manage and control something that's ultimately uncontrollable and unmanageable.
Yeah.
And if you look at horror films, they frequently do this. The monster will basically chase the protagonist around, and it'll look, terrible through three-fourths of the film. But in the denouement, at the climax, you get to vanquish the beast, and order is restored.
And there's that suggests, if you think of this in Freudian terms, another reason why it is we find monster stories appealing and satisfying is that the monster is it's the id run amok.
Yeah.
And there's something kind of, and it's a, as I'm sure as he would have said, that this is an expression of what we would like to be able to do, but because we're civilized individuals. We reign, you know, and it's the superego is doing its job when it vanquishes the monster, but it's the id saying, man, I'd really like to be out and party.
I think that's crucial. That's a crucial point. I mean, this is why I think vampires and zombies, which we're very fascinated in today, these days, they represent this kind of more primitive creature. You know, it's us with our superego stripped off. You know, you can act with impunity, do whatever you want, rape, pillage, burn. But of course, that is the point too, is that there's something attractive about that, but also repulsive, because those are the most humanizing qualities. Those humanized qualities are missing in the creature. So there's a sort of attraction-repulsion dynamic.
We have a caller here, someone in Tazewell County. Let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Just listening to the continuation of your conversation there, I'm wondering if this business of monsters isn't where racism and sexism stems from. But what I really called to talk about was, I don't think our advances in technology or our technological sophistication has rid us of monsters. I think it's just changed them. Look at the popularity of the TV program Battlestar Galactica and other things like that, where the monsters are technological beings that we have created, and they've come back to haunt us, come back to get us. And, you know, I just think monsters change as society changes.
I'm sure our guest would agree.
Yeah, I think the caller makes a good point. The fact that we have all this phenomenal technology, which science fiction narratives are really celebrating, doesn't change some of these universal aspects of the monster. The Frankenstein novel that Shelley wrote is oftentimes considered a kind of romantic criticism of too much science and playing God. And here we have we're probably closer to that horrific ideal, I think, for many, than we've ever been. We can get into the genome now in ways that no previous generation has ever been able to do, and I think that's frightening for many of the same reasons that the original Frankenstein story was frightening. I also think that the caller's right about monsterology was a way in which different cultures sort of demonized each other and laid down a kind of template for thinking about racism and I think perhaps even sexism.
Well, thanks for the comment. I appreciate it. I guess one thing that I think is interesting and I'd like to get your thoughts about is that if you look at monsters in popular culture, at least over the past couple of decades, we seemed that we had a period when we had where the monsters were machines, no doubt if reflecting our ambivalence about our technology. I think it's interesting that now we're at the point where we're back and we're, as you said, we're fascinated with zombies and we're fascinated with vampires. I think it's interesting that we have now come around to the old-fashioned idea of contagion.
Yeah,
as being an important force here.
Yeah, I wonder if it's probably no accident that vampires and zombies, which basically can transfer their monstrosity by just a bite, it's no accident that that's probably happening in an era, you know, that's very familiar with things like swine flu and SARS and AIDS. These kinds of worries about easily transmittable diseases that could kill you, I think they find their way into the fears of our monster narratives. And if you look at the ancient, or if you look at the medieval world, if you ran across a witch or some evil doer, they were basically considered to be metaphysically different than you and I. They had made some deal with the devil, and God had crossed them off his list, and they were sort of bad through and through. But here, nowadays, you have the idea that you could actually become a monster, with just, you know, with a bite on the neck, or, you know, the zombie actually just scratches your arm, and before you know it, the disease has overtaken you. These do represent lots of our fears and vulnerabilities about actual and real diseases and contagion, as you said.
Yeah, and coming back to a point where there would have been a point where we would have been confident that our technology, our science, could have taken care of those things for us, and now maybe we're not so sure anymore.
Yeah, you do see that reflected, I think, in... If you're a fan of horror films or sci-fi genre, you'll notice that like when these films appear in the 1950s, there's frequently a very pro-science. Usually, in the climax of the film, the scientist is able to solve the problem, either scientists or the military. But now, if you look at films in the same genre, science is actually causing more problems and rarely solves it. It usually ends up being sort of the lone proletariat person who manages to put the monster back in the box or destroy the evil doer. And it's usually science is now grouped with big business and as one of the main causes of problems.
Our guest is Stephen Osma. He's professor of philosophy at Columbia College in Chicago, where he holds the title of Distinguished Scholar, and he's author of a number of books, and his most recent is On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. It's published by the Oxford University Press, kind of about the stories that people over time and place have told about monsters and what those stories tell us about our inner lives, what's going on in our heads, how we think about ourselves, how we think about the world, and how maybe over time those things really haven't changed very much. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I would like to take the conversation and a great subject back to maternalism, which in my opinion was benign, progressive, and without overt violence. Then, as the patriarchs, the poisoned paternalist of the matriarchal set, seized power, and then everything changed. And a question I might put in with this is about God and his maleness, his. And I've addressed this subject before on David's program. Forgive me if I'm being redundant, but I think it is something that needs to be addressed. And the horrors that we now are experiencing worldwide and the fallout from male aggression that has become more intensified. But if, in my opinion, the maternalist social organization of early humans was, as I've said, benign and progressive until males killed the matriarchy followed maternalism, and matriarchy became authoritarian and seized upon by the decayed paternalist, and power was seized, and the matriarch killed. And but maternalism had decayed too into back to Marxist dialectic, and the things that occurred after those paradigms began to fade away. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I guess my own view is that the matriarchy that you're describing is, my own view is that ancient hominid and Homo sapien history is very shrouded in mystery, and the relationship between men and women, patriarchy and matriarchy, is oftentimes, I think, a kind of projection of our own particular, our own era in time and our own concerns back into the past, a past that we don't know that much about and that is highly speculative when we make those kind of claims. So I don't feel in any way informed enough to sort of comment on that. But I do think there is an interesting point here, which is that monsters are frequently As I said at the outset, the kind of creature or enemy that you cannot reason with and that you cannot negotiate with. And so if you look at the literature of monsters, it is frequently men who play the role of monster killer. Now, that's not always the case. One thinks of the character Ripley in the Alien series, who's a wonderful monster killer female. But overwhelmingly, you find that they're men, and one wonders if that's not because men are stereotypically sort of meet threats with aggression, with violence. And so the monster is sort of the sort of symbol of that which the man has to sort of fight off. And so you think about Beowulf killing Grendel and his mother and so forth. And so I think there's something interesting there in the gender dynamic. I also think that the caller brings up an interesting point about God. If you look at monsters in the sort of pre-monotheistic era, they existed as expressions either of nature or of the bad gods, the ones who were evil or wicked, because you think it was basically polytheism or some kind of dualistic relationship between a good god and a bad god. When you get to Western monotheism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, you have this new problem, which is how do you make sense out of these monsters if God is all good, all-knowing, all-powerful? It then raises the sort of problem of evil. Why are there supposedly these monsters out there? God must want them to be out there and that sort of thing. So there's a rich conversation that happens. And so in the book I talk about St. Augustine, St. Aquinas, and how they're trying to handle that problem.
Hmm. And just one other thing that strikes me as interesting about, you'd mentioned the alien. And it strikes me that if you look at a lot of monsters, and I'm not sure how far this goes back, but if you look at, say, the golden age of monsters in modern popular culture, clearly they are gendered and they are overwhelmingly male. And what strikes me is one of the things interesting about Alien is not only do we have this very strong action hero who is a woman, but the monster is also female.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. And there are in fact female monsters in history. One thinks about Medusa and so forth. But you're right. There is the Freudians do think that there's something in the male psyche that is deeply fearful and can't quite understand the female. And so the Freudians think that, well, these monsters like the Medusa or maybe Alien represent some male fears about procreation and about the female psyche, which it can't quite grasp or understand. I also think what's interesting about the Alien series is that you have there a kind of monster, again, very different from the medieval monsters. Here you could only have this creature sort of after Darwin, because what you have in the case of the alien is not some supernatural demon, but in fact just another biological species that evolved somewhere else, and it just so happens that it wants to use your body to incubate its young in, and that's a very Darwinian view of nature, that all animals are trying to basically reproduce themselves, and we have been fortunate on this planet to be sort of at the top for at least recent history, and so these alien monster narratives sort of put us back in the survival game and see how we fare.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank the caller. Let's go to Roberts next for another call. This is line one. Hello. Is there a caller there? Line one? Okay. How about Urbana line two? Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to ask about any relationship you might see between monsters and demons or demonization. Is demonization the process by which we turn people into monsters? And does this have any relevance to political propaganda? For example, the demonization of foreign leaders when we dislike what they do. What happened with Saddam Hussein, for example? The classic cases being Hitler and Stalin, of course. We can't seem to avoid invoking in recent political debate, and they were considered monsters, I suppose, in some symbolic sense. So we no longer look at physical deformities so much as mental illness, I suppose, and keep calling them madmen. So are these products of demonization in the mass media are present-day monsters. Thanks, I'll hang up.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I do try to address that in the book. I think that people like Saddam Hussein, Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot is a perfect example. I lived in Cambodia for a while and got to see firsthand some of the repercussions of his madness. But I think we oftentimes apply the word monster to these characters, and I think some of it is legitimate. When somebody acts in a way that is hard for us to understand in terms of the heinous carnage that it creates and the social the misery that it causes, I think we're legitimate in applying the term monster when people basically go off this map of human motivation. But I think the caller's right. We oftentimes overapply it, and we have a tendency to basically demonize or monsterize people who we are, we want to engage in for military or economic gain. And so you see, this is, I think, mass media has actually made it more efficient as a system, but of course it's very old. We have, you know, flyers that were printed up, you know, in like the, in basically in like the 15th, 16th century, which demonized Turks and Muslims and draws them as with monstrous sort of body parts and strange configurations. And we've done this for a long time, sort of across the civilization, you know, gulf, by treating our enemies as basically uncivilized. And it goes both ways. I think we oftentimes will look at Al-Qaeda and Taliban legitimately as enemies, but also we sort of overdo it a little bit, wild-eyed jihad monsters. And from their side, I think they see us as being uncivilized and monstrous with regard to our sexual immodesty. You know, they think that the West is basically a giant orgy and that's really monstrous. So that kind of monsterizing or demonizing is still alive and well, and it is part of a long tradition, I think, of xenophobia.
Yeah, where the monster always was the other, and
right.
Whether that was alien invaders in the 1950s that clearly were a stand-in for the Russians and
right.
for the threat of communism, or whether it would have been some sort, you know, an earlier time when it would have been about foreigners. And the threat of immigrants, or the you know, that it was part of this us and them dynamic that people probably have been living with for a long time.
Yeah, if you look at the ancient world, there's some actually kind of amusing examples, but then it gets more and more disturbing as you go through history. The amusing examples were there was a belief by the ancients that in India and in Africa, two places that they didn't know very well or quite even where they were, the belief was that there were races of men who had no head, but their faces appeared in their chest. These were called the Blemmyi, and also the Kynocephalus, which is a dog-headed man. And you see and there's a variety of other ones which I discuss in the book, but you see these things, these creatures are believed in all through the ancient world, up all through the medieval world, and even Shakespeare is referring to them, not quite sure whether they're real or not. But what happens is that many of the ways in which they're described and thought about become a kind of proxy or template for thinking about race. There's a wonderful, by and large, people are afraid and don't want to deal with them. But St. Augustine actually argued that, well, the thing to do is to try and meet some of these monsters and talk to them. And if you talk to them and you find that they're rational, well, then they basically are, he thought, then they could be saved. You know, they were capable of redemption. So he thought we have to bring them in the fold, but it's going to be a sort of a test we'll have to give them.
Yeah. Another caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, line 3. Hello.
Hi there. I tuned in late, so I hope that I'm not being redundant. But may I ask, do you believe there is such a thing as demon possession?
I do not believe in literal demon possession. If by that you mean a supernatural creature gets inside a natural creature, I don't believe in that at all. However, I do think that that's a fairly accurate way of describing how it must feel to somebody who has certain forms of psychopathology. So, for example, we'll use a very elaborate sort of scientific psychological language to describe somebody who's a serial killer. But in point of fact, in many of these people's diaries, and in fact now we're finding blogs of people who are committing heinous crimes, you will find that they describe their own experience very much as a kind of possession. Something is in them, and it's driving them to do something, and they're losing control, and you can see their control slipping away in their own description of their madness. So as a sort of phenomenological description of what's happening to them, I think it's probably is a pretty accurate description of how it feels to them. But I don't believe in the actual metaphysics of demon possession, no.
I would be interested in your evaluation of a case described by Dr. James Dobson. Now, he's a well-known Christian Ph.D. psychologist. He's a child psychologist.
Sure, I know Dobson.
And Dr. Dobson investigated a case of a child. It was a boy in his early teens, as I remember. I think I can remember the case well enough to describe it. This child was supposedly demon-possessed, and Dr. Dobson was called to the house when the demon possession, was active. By the time Dr. Dobson arrived at the house, this boy had calmed down. But Dr. Dobson said that the child was exhausted, completely exhausted, that he had exhibited superhuman strength, and that he spoke in a voice that was not his own. And Dr. Dobson, here's this Ph.D. psychologist, says he did not know of any diagnosis which would explain these symptoms.
Yeah, I guess my own view on that is that I have absolutely no doubts about bizarre behavior and even really extreme behavior on the part of somebody who's undergoing something like this. My own view is that brain science is telling us way more than we ever knew before about how the brain works and how some of this, what I would call abnormal behavior, is generated by the brain in forms of seizure or just other forms of psychopathology. And I do think that Dobson is basically interpreting an event, and he's giving it a supernatural interpretation that the data does not necessarily support. There's alternative ways to interpret that material. And so I think that for my own view is that if Dobson's right, we have to assume the existence of a whole lot of metaphysics, that there's demons out there and that there's a whole supernatural world that we can't see. And I think that the route of a scientific explanation is one that makes much fewer assumptions and therefore strikes me as a more reasonable explanation given sort of Occam's razor sort of criteria.
Mm. Our guest is Stephen Osmey. He's professor of philosophy at Columbia College in Chicago, where he holds the title of Distinguished Scholar. He's the author of a number of books. His most recent is titled On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. Oxford University Press is the publisher, and it tries to explore how it is that people over time, different cultures, have thought about monsters and the kind of monsters that they have been afraid of, and how that, in fact, does reflect genuine fears that we might have that go way back, that have to do with the threats to our survival, but it also has at least something to do with our own inner demons, and we'll make those metaphorical, and how it is that we think about them and try to understand them. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, do people still report sea monsters, or is that something that belongs to a past age?
That's a great question, because that's my own terrible phobia, is the sea monster. I think one of the great things about sea monsters is it gets us at the question of cryptozoology. Cryptids are usually creatures that we don't actually fit anywhere in the established normal taxonomy of creatures, but which we may suspect to be out there somewhere, just undiscovered. And Cryptozoology gets made fun of a lot because, there's always somebody dragging the Loch Ness trying to find the monster, and it's a bit of a joke. But the basic impulse behind it strikes me as really interesting, which is that there are parts of the world that are unexplored, and isn't it possible that there could be species there that are procreating and be a viable biological group, and could we in fact come across something quite fantastic? And what lends credence to this is of course the fact that we sometimes do find stuff, especially in the oceans now, that we thought was either extinct, like the coelacanth fish, which we thought was completely gone, and now we find them living off the coasts of Japan, or the giant squids, which we're getting more and more data on. And so I feel like there's always this door that's open a little bit to the idea of creatures, especially in the sea, where we know only a small percentage of what's out there. There's always that door open to creatures that we would historically call sea monsters.
So they were monsters once, but now they're just maybe something that's new to science.
I mean, the Kraken is that creature that sailors sort of celebrated for centuries, and one suspects that it was basically a kind of a monster version of giant squid or giant octopi. We're not sure exactly, but we think that it had a real zoological origin, but then it got mixed up with fantasy and was called a monster.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Next caller here would be in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Follow through on the sea comparison in the Smithsonian Institute. In the very first section, there is a portrayal and exhibit of sea life animals that have become monstrosities because of the deformities that nature and chemicals and other things have been producing. But going back to another monstrosity among us is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was portrayed as good and evil in some certain manner, and then it became a leaping off point for someone who wrote a book recently of something that actually occurred in history called The Creature from Jekyll Island. And that creature was the Federal Reserve System. He expounds to great extent upon the reason and the formation of the Federal Reserve System and all the people and bankers and investors throughout the financial world gathered at Jekyll Island and decided to come up with this sort of standardization for producing our monetary system, which became the Federal Reserve System. And he characterized it as the creature from Jekyll Island. I thought it toss it in. Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, I guess that among other things, what that says is just how attractive a metaphor that is, and
that's
how
right.
You can take that and bend that to fit various sorts of things.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't too long ago that Obama, when he was running for office, one of his advisors referred to Hillary Clinton as a monster, and then this advisor promptly lost her job. And so it just tells you that the monster epithet has a lot of symbolic range, and it also carries a lot of weight.
But that, I guess is this as old a notion that I think that people would have had this idea that human beings were capable at least of doing good and doing evil, and that people were not purely one or the other, and that that there were these dark corners, these dark closets that we have, where who knows exactly what's lurking. We do our best to keep the door closed, but that they're there, and who knows under what circumstances that door just might open.
Yeah, the Jekyll and Hyde, I think, metaphor is a good one that and I think many people will read it in a Freudian way, but of course that idea goes back to the ancient Greeks as well. Plato and Aristotle thought there are forces in us that are troublesome and have to be retrained and educated. And so if you look at Plato's Republic, he says, imagine a monster. The Greeks were so fascinated by chimeras, which are these hybrid creatures, half this, half that. And he says, imagine all these demons and creatures, and then encase it in a human form so you can't see these creatures. And he says that's the symbol of the lust and desire and appetites that are inside all human beings. So the goal of good education, he thought, was can you get your rationality, which has just a little bit of power, to enlist the strength of your heart, which he called thumos, you know, just the spirited part of you, to basically discipline this multi-headed monster, which is basically your appetites and your drives and desires. So that metaphor has also been a part of this language and this way of talking about how do we basically create ethical societies and how do we create ethical people.
We have it. Have some other callers here. We'll get try to get at least one more. Biment, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to bring up the case of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is often misinterpreted. And I read an interview with the director. I believe his name was Don Siegel. And most people think that that movie is about communism. It is not. He states that it is about corporatism. It's about the people in the gray flannel suits. He was also embarrassed by the name of the film, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and blamed the corporate, quote, pods for giving it that name.
That's a good story. I like that. I guess that just shows you that that you can use these, you can use this frame to tell a lot of different kind of stories. And so, you know, you pick your monster, and then you can go with that.
Yeah, I love that movie. It's one of my favorites. It cracks me up that they had to reshoot the ending because it scared people so bad, and put sort of a more secure ending on it, on what was originally a very paranoid ending. But the caller's right. The notion of monster has now also become the idea of if a corporate or political dehumanized zombie, somebody who's so into the system that they can't recognize the human beings that are in the system. And that's a sort of new notion of monster that I trace back and talk with regard to Hannah Arendt's famous discussion of the Nazis, the banality of evil.
Uh-huh. All right, let's go to another caller. This is Champagne, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just had a quick question. I don't know if you have time to really get into it or have thought a lot about it, but I imagine you probably have. I was just curious as to whether you believe there's any evidence that these ideas of monsters or demons or whatever are at all an effective way of dealing with things that we don't understand. You know, like mental illness was often taken as demon possession for many, many decades, and in fact, I think still is sometimes. And but that sometimes our scientific approaches and treatments seem, you know, completely ineffective or whatever. Mm. If there's any value or usefulness in kind of approaching that from a little bit more of a metaphysical viewpoint or whatever. I don't know if that was clear, but.
Yeah, I think it raises an interesting issue, which is we've been talking a lot about monsters as creating fear, and I think that's definitely the case. But they have also been ways in which we in the West have talked about those gaps in our knowledge, things we don't understand, things that are really mysterious. Of course, if you look at the ancient maps, wherever the regions that were unexplored, there would just be a little sign there that said, you know, beyond here lies monsters. And part of that is to, you know, sort of instill fear, but part of it is just to say, hey, here's some phenomenon or some creature or whatever that we simply don't have a place for in our current understanding, whether it be scientific or whether it be religious. And so the monster always represents this sort of radical outsider. That's not always bad. It doesn't always have to be accompanied by fear, but it does represent this sort of epistemological breakdown, like here's where the knowledge just doesn't come together for us.
Mm. Just one other thing, just as we have about a minute or so left, it's interesting how much a part of hero narratives monster battling is. And I was sitting looking through your book last night, and I just happened to look over to my bookshelf, and my eye lit on a recent translation that I have of the story of Gilgamesh. which is, at least in Western tradition, it's said to be the oldest story we have. And one important episode there is when Gilgamesh and his buddy Enkidu, they go off together and they fight a monster.
Right.
And for the two men, it's very, very frightening. And it's partly about them bonding, and it's also partly about them conquering their fears.
Right.
I think actually it comes, you know, there are also consequences of killing the monster that come back later in the story. But I thought, man, this is the oldest story we've got, and it has this monster feature to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, it is true that most monster stories have the heroic component. And I think it's true that the monster represents sort of the ultimate threat that you have to test yourself against. So you frequently will see that there is part of this lesson is, to those of us who then read and embrace these stories, part of the lesson is don't give up. You know, whatever's coming at you, fight on. And you see that it's frequently part of monster stories, and the whole genre celebrates the heroic response to monsters.
Yeah, and it's I suppose in the end it may turn out to be a hollow kind of promise, but we do tell ourselves in the end, no matter how terrible it seems to be, it's going to be okay.
Right.
At least like to tell ourselves it's going to be okay.
That's right.
Well, we'll tell everybody it's going to be okay, and if you'd like to read more on the subject, and it's a very interesting book, the book to look at is On Monsters. The subtitle is An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears, published by the Oxford University Press, by our guest Stephen Osme. He's professor of philosophy at Columbia College in Chicago. Thanks very much. Focus 580, our program supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Coming up a little bit later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn will be talking about the life and career of Herbert Lawrence Block, better known as Herblock. He was an editorial cartoonist, maybe one of the most famous. He began his career in 1929, and it spanned 13 American presidencies, including the one that got underway in 2001. Coming up today in the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste will be talking about his work as well as the act of political cartooning. Her guest will be Harry Katz, author of the new book, Herblock, The Life and Work of the Great Political Cartoonist. That's coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Show gets underway at noon here on AM 580. In the next hour of this show, we'll be talking about tackling the problem of e-waste. And what we mean there is old computers and televisions and cell phones. What do we do with them? More on that in a bit. First, though, we'll take a break for an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
At 10:59 with this market update, I'm Tom Rogers. The commodity market's still rather strong on the basis mainly of a falling U.S. dollar. However, the soybeans have seen a little decline in the nearby contracts. The nearby November right now is actually on the downside, the only contract in the grain board that is down right now. December wheat in Kansas City is up 10 cents at 535.5. Dease wheat in Chicago is up a nickel at 528. March is up 6 at 549. December corn right now is at 396 a bushel, up a penny and a half. March corn, 411 and a quarter, up 2 and a quarter. May corn, 421, up 2. In the energy stocks, December crude oil at 79.42 a barrel, up 37. And in soybeans, the November contract is down a half at 961. January, though, up 2 at 970. March, up a penny and a half at 975 and a half. May still 16 and a half up at 994. December bean.